I'd like to call the meeting to order, and even though we are in the time slot and in the room where usually the Health and Human Services Finance Committee meets, for members who are on both committees, we're in the Policy Committee today as we approach deadlines, so don't want to confuse anybody here. So the first bill, let's see, we do have a quorum, and the first order of business would be to approve the minutes of March 13th. Do I have a motion? Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of March 13, 2013. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First bill that we're going to hear today is House File 1139, which is my bill. So I'm going to ask Representative Benson to take the gavel.
Good morning, Chair Liebling. Would you like me to move the the bill, or would you like to move the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1139, that it be recommended to pass, and I believe it's going to Judiciary.
That's correct.
That's okay, so that it be recommended to pass and go to the Judiciary Committee.
Committee, Representative Liebling moves House File 1139 to be recommended and passed and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Liebling, I believe you have a DE1 amendment.
Pass the bill.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. And we don't want to vote on the bill yet. We're not voting on the bill yet.
No.
So, okay. So,
sorry.
Mr. Chair and members, I have the DE1 amendment, and first of all, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment just to put the bill in the shape in which I would like to discuss it. So, Mr. Chair, if we could vote on that motion.
Right. Thank you. Any discussion on the DE1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Okay, thank you, members. So, members, this is a very important and often difficult topic that we're discussing today, which is our civil commitment system for sex offenders. And as you know, or you may know, a federal court is hearing a class action lawsuit regarding the constitutionality of our civil commitment system for sex offenders in the state. This is an issue that's very difficult because, as we know, there's a significant public safety concern around sex offenders, and the public is very interested in this topic. And what often happens is that this is an issue that gets used in campaigns. And that dynamic around this issue has really prevented this legislature from solving what is really a significant problem for all of us. It's a significant problem not only because we have the highest number per capita of civilly committed sex offenders in the country, but this is a significant and growing cost to us. And besides that, there are significant questions here about whether we are getting the best public safety that we can for our money. So we are locking up a small number of people who commit, who have committed sex offenses, and we're committing them for a very long time. We have not released anybody out of our civil commitment system. Now, just so members understand, civil commitment is not a conviction. It's not supposed to be a punishment. People are they're committed because they're deemed to be dangerous to the public and in need of treatment. So in a sense, we are putting them away because of a future dangerousness. And that has been considered to be constitutional only insofar as they're there for treatment. If we have a program from which nobody is ever released, after a while it begins to look like it's not really treatment, and there is where you get the constitutional problem. Because constitutionally, you can't just put people away because of what they might do in the future. You have to, you can lock them up for crimes they've committed, that they've been convicted of, but once they finish that sentence, you can't just hold them forever because of concerns that they may do it again. So the challenge we have as a legislature is to try to figure out how to best use our limited resources to give our the public the most safety that we can. And that means treating those who can be treated, maybe in a very secure setting, but maybe in a less secure setting, if that can be done consistent with public safety, and focusing our most intense, expensive resources on those who really need those resources in order to protect the public. So before we get into sort of into the details of what I've got in the DE1 amendment, I want you to hear a little bit more about this. And I want you to understand, members, that this is an issue that cannot be solved unless it's solved bipartisanly. And I very much appreciate Representative Abler's help on this. He's also a member of the Civil Commitment Task Force along with me. And the task force has been working very diligently to put forward some recommendations. Unfortunately, the timeline is such that the task force really can't finish all of its work before we have to begin to move on this. But members of the task force have been very involved in discussing these issues. We've tried to take a lot of the recommendations from them. I've worked very closely with the people from our Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So what you've got before you is definitely a work in process. I make no pretension that we've reached the ultimate solution on these issues. We are definitely continuing to work with stakeholders to get the very best thing we can. But we're not there yet. The real question is whether all of you are going to be able to come together around this to allow us to move forward at all. And that, I think, is what the federal court is looking for. And I'm going to ask Chief Justice Magnuson, former Chief Justice, to come down here with me and talk to you a little bit more about that. But we have a very serious problem here. And again, unless we all come together with a willingness to solve it, and not use it for political grandstanding, we are not going to be able to solve it. And then we put our state at risk of having a federal court come in and either tell us how to solve it, which could be very expensive for us, or in the worst case, actually just simply declare our program to be unconstitutional and shut it down. So those are really the choices, and I'm really here kind of asking you to trust me, because really, unless we have some trust in this process, we are simply not going to solve this problem. So I'm going to turn it over now to Chief Justice Magnuson and ask him to correct me if I said anything incorrect and flesh it out for us a little bit more.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. If you identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony, please.
I will. Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling. Members, I'm Eric Magnuson. I am a lawyer practicing in Minneapolis. I am the former Chief Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. I have been appointed to chair a civil commitment task force at the direction of Judge Donovan Frank of the United States District Court for the District of Minnesota. If you're not familiar with the details of the civil commitment process, I would highly recommend that you or your staff go to the task force website. You just Google Minnesota Sex Offender Task Force. It will take you there. You have a complete record of what we have done, the issues that we're considering, but we also have things such as summaries of current Minnesota law, a comparison of Minnesota law to the laws of other states, and the detailed studies that have examined the sex offender program in Minnesota, beginning with Governor Polenyi's task force in 2005 through the legislative auditor's report that came out in 2011. Representative Liebling has outlined the issue for you fairly straightforwardly. Minnesota is one of 20 states in the country that civilly commits sex offenders after they have served their criminal sentences. Minnesota has the highest commitment rate of any of those states per capita, by a considerable margin. Minnesota has the fewest releases from commitment of any state in the country, specifically one in the past two decades. Persons civilly committed as sexually dangerous persons or sexual psychopathic personalities have already served their criminal sentence. This is not an issue of further punishment. Under the Constitution, it is impermissible to incarcerate people simply because you're afraid they may do something bad in the future. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Minority Report with Tom Cruise, but in a not very attractive future, they arrested people for future crimes. We don't do that in this country under our Constitution. We may nonetheless commit people who suffer from an illness if that illness causes them to pose a threat to themselves or to the public. I think we're all familiar with the mental commitment of people who are dangerous to themselves. It happens quite frequently. But we also commit people who, because of a medical, emotional, psychological condition, pose a threat to the public. Now, the Constitution requires that people committed for that reason receive treatment. You cannot say you're ill, we're just going to lock you up. You have to treat them. And if you don't, then the only conclusion courts draw is that you're really punishing them. You're not treating them. And that violates the Constitution. Representative Liebling and I have both mentioned the federal lawsuit. It is a class action brought by civilly committed individuals who are challenging not the concept of commitment. That's already been approved by the United States Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court. In theory, you can do this, but you've got to do it in the right way. And this lawsuit is a challenge to the manner in which the program is run. There are serious problems with the current MSOP program. They are not new. They are not newly discovered. If you go back, as I said, to the 2005 task force appointed by Governor Plenty, they identify a number of problems. And one of the biggest problems is people get into the system and never get out. It's like a Venus flytrap, as my co-chair, former chief judge of the federal court, Jim Rosenbaum, says. It is, in essence, a life sentence. And that is a huge problem. Another problem is that the presumptive placement of these people when they are committed is at the most secure facility, Moose Lake. It costs $120,000 a year to keep someone at Moose Lake, when many of those people could effectively be treated and the public could be ensured of its safety if you put them someplace else. Now, I'm not saying there aren't people that don't pose such a threat that they should not be securely committed. But to treat everyone in the system in exactly the same way, the most expensive way, is inappropriate. The task force I chair was appointed by the federal court to address three specific topics. We were given until the end of this coming year to address two of them, but the federal court said one of them I want you to talk about right away, and that is the topic of what the court called less restrictive alternatives. I think it's better to think of it as the secure and intensive treatment and supervision concept that has now come into the legislation. It is an alternative to locking people up behind razor wire at Moose Lake. We made those recommendations in early December. That was the deadline that the federal court gave us. And we believe the federal court gave us that deadline so that you would have something tangible to work from, so that you would have something that you could look at and talk about in a bipartisan way, because our task force has no political orientation. Judge Rosenbaum and I, if we are, well, we're not considered Democrats. How's that? I don't know. I don't know that I'm considered a Republican either after the unallotment decision, but I leave that to all of you. What it is, is it's a nonpartisan group of people who are vitally interested in this topic and want to make recommendations that are best for the state of Minnesota. There is urgency to you taking action. A federal court has great power, but it is the power of a broadsword. It is not a scalpel. Judges in general, and federal judges in particular, do not micromanage state operations. They either say, there's nothing constitutionally wrong, go ahead and keep doing what you're doing, even though I think it's inappropriate, or the judge says, you've violated the Constitution. And the judge at that point will say, fix it. And the judge will say, fix it now. And the judge will say, I don't really care how much it costs. Fix it now. That happened in the state of Washington. At our website, you have the pleadings from the Turay litigation, where their sex offender program was found to be unconstitutional. And the state didn't get around to fixing it, and the judge started levying fines and holding state officials in contempt, and finally forced them to move far faster and far more expensively than they had wanted to. By analogy, in the federal prison system in California, the conditions were found to violate the Constitution. They were so bad. The federal judge said, fix it. California didn't. And the judge says, okay, I'm going to release 1,000 prisoners on Monday because you can't keep them in unconstitutional circumstances. Now, I'm not saying that there will be a wholesale release by the federal judge of people civilly committed, but the opportunity to make a rational judgment about how best to serve the citizens of the state of Minnesota is yours. It is not the federal courts. And so I would urge you to consider this a matter of priority, to give it careful consideration, and to recognize that it is an issue that affects all citizens in Minnesota and is not a partisan issue. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Madam Chair, would you wish to take questions now, or would you like us to hear the commissioner first?
If the commissioner would want to come down and make some comments, I think that would be great. Maybe Chief Justice could stay here, and then we could have questions before we get into the details of the bill. And I just would like to give her the opportunity. I know she's has a bit of a scheduling crunch today.
Good morning, Commissioner. If you will identify yourself and present your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. I think over the years there have been a number of work groups and task forces, and this task force is only the most recent one, that have looked at making recommendations about the use of civil commitment for sex offenders in Minnesota. I certainly want to start out by thanking Chief Justice Magnuson, Judge Rosenbaum, Representatives Liebling and Abler for serving on this task force. But I think looking across the years, there are several things that have come to the forefront, and this bill addresses some of the two that are the most critical. But before I make comments on what's in this bill, I want to be really clear with all of you about what's not in this bill. This bill does not change the criteria for civil commitment. This bill does not change the standards for provisional discharge or discharge. It does not make it easier for anyone to be provisionally discharged or discharged from this program. But this bill does do two very important things, take two steps, which I think are important reform steps, which have been recommended by a number of different groups on a bipartisan basis. And I think, as Justice Magnuson said, also addresses two of the biggest concerns from the federal judge. And the first is what we lawyers would call bifurcation of the civil commitment process for sex offenders. Right now, when a court has to decide whether to civilly commit someone as a sex offender, they make that decision and they're faced with a choice. You either civilly commit someone to this very secure, expensive place in Moose Lake, or you let them go on the streets. So what this bill does is say we're going to have that same standard, the same legal standard the legislature has in place today for judges to decide whether to civilly commit someone, but then we're going to have a second step and say if they're going to be civilly committed, where should they be civilly committed to? Moose Lake, as it is today, remains an option. And for many people, is the very, very much the appropriate option. But there should be more than one option, about where to place people. And, but, of course, to do that, you need alternatives, and we don't have those alternatives today. A primary recommendation we received from the task force to the legislature and to me last December was try and create alternative options. And that's one of the things I wanted you to know, that at the department what we did was we issued in late December an RFI, request for information, to get information from providers across the state and actually across the country so that they could tell us if we're going to create, if we can create these alternatives, tell us about, would you be willing to do it? If you're willing to do it, what would the security be like? What would the treatment be like? What would the cost be? And we have that information. We just received it. We're compiling it. And we received 21 different responses from people across our state who said, who gave us information about what these secure alternatives could be. So that the courts, when they're facing that decision, instead of being Moose Lake or on the streets, it's Moose Lake, and if they're committed, it's Moose Lake or another alternative. And I must say, I know that there was a Court of Appeals decision just in the last year where the Court of Appeals overturned a decision to commit. And so, and then it was, okay, instead of Moose Lake, it is someone who the county attorney wanted to be committed who is on the streets. The second, I think, important step forward that this bill takes is very also, once again, consistent with the recommendation from the Office of Legislative Auditor. And it's really a best practice in other civil commitment, with other states who have civil commitment, and that is regular reviews of clients in the sex offender treatment program. Those regular reviews then can go to the court, and the courts can decide, should something differently be done? Once again, doesn't change the standards about the courts have to decide whether or not someone can be provisionally discharged, but it gets up-to-date information to the court so they can decide if the standards for provisional discharge are met and how the individual is doing in treatment. I think those are two steps forward. And I just want to commend Representative Liebling for not only addressing those steps in this bill, but really also addressing sexual violence prevention. You know, so that we're not just looking, kind of spending our resources downstream on civil commitment and incarceration, but are really trying to focus more on prevention. You know, members, I recognize very much the political nature of this discussion and this decision. And I remember sitting here about a year, almost a year ago, with many of you who are on this committee when there was very heated discussion about the provisional discharge of Clarence Opheim. But I think that these two steps forward are appropriate. They are also measured. And they will protect our ability to continue this program, protect the client's rights in the program, and protect public safety by doing both of those things. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. We're going to have some questions, and hopefully the questions can be directed to the testifiers because at least one has other commitments. So if you keep that in mind, everyone. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to start out and say I want to just commend you, Representative Liebling, for taking on this issue. You know, you and I don't always agree, but I have a lot of respect that you want to do this. I don't want to make it a political football either, okay? It's a very difficult issue, and anybody who served on the committee deserves my appreciation and respect, okay? Because I know you want safety, and yet you have to balance that against constitutional rights. But I get a couple questions, and I'd like to direct them to the former Supreme Court Justice, okay? Now, first thing, I'm not a lawyer, okay? I don't pretend to be one. Tell you the truth, I wouldn't want to be one.
I was about to say congratulations.
Okay. All right. Here's some things, when I look at this bill, that I would need to consider supporting something like this. Number one, I think we have to end the idea of when you have a level 3, which is the worst of the worst, is my understanding, and from the provisional people that we looked at to get out, I mean, one of them had 100 different victims, some as young as 6 years old, okay? I mean, it just, very depressing situations. But for me, we would need to change the law and say, if you become a level 3 violent, heinous criminal, you get life imprisonment without chance of parole. In other words, let's end putting additional people into this program. All right? Because the reason I say that, when I was on Public Safety Committee, the people who ran the program, I asked the question, does your treatment cure these offenders? And the response was, no, we're trying to help them live with it. Okay? Now, I understand that. So you can't cure these people. There is no cure, according to the testimony that I received last year. And so if we can't cure them, then I think for their good and the safety of the children and citizens in our state, let's stop putting them into these provisional treatment centers. Let's give them life imprisonment without chance of a parole. Now, I have some additional caveats with that, which I can discuss with Representative Liebling offline. So that's one thing I would need. The second thing I would need, and the former Supreme Court, I'm sorry, Magnuson,
yes, sir.
After I make these statements, I want to hear your perspective on it, okay? The second thing I would need is that Representative Hillstrom has a bill that would charge people in this provisional treatment that commit felonies while in the treatment to be charged and tried, and if convicted, returned back to the prison system. To me, if we have a large or high number of the current sex offenders in this treatment center committing felonies while they're in the provisional treatment, that they should be sent back to the prison system, much less released back into society somehow. I don't know where Representative Hillstrom's bill is. I signed on to it. I told her I strongly support it. I hope it's considered. That would be a necessary part for me before I'd support something like this, okay? So we can see by their actions in the treatment center that they're not ready for release. They're already doing felonies, okay? And the other thing I just want to say about myself is, you know, I did 13 years of jail ministry on a voluntary basis before I was on the school board, before I got elected to the legislature. But anyway, I understand the problem with some of these people. Just from a layperson standpoint, and had many discussions. Some of the discussions I had were with prisoners who stayed afterwards by themselves because of things they had done to children, okay, and how sorry they were about it at the time. And so I understand that it's an addictive quality that overrules their conscience and their wills, and they simply are compelled to do certain things to other people, mainly women and children, that are just carry terrible consequences.
We maybe ask the Chief Justice to respond to the two questions. Would you like those clarified?
I think I have them in mind, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With regard to your first point about criminal sentences for level 3 sex offenders, I understand your concern. It really is a separate issue, although not unrelated, but a separate issue from civil commitment. Civil commitment occurs after the criminal sentence, whatever it is, has been served. So it, from a constitutional standpoint, you're looking at the appropriate punishment for a crime that has been proven, the guilt has been established. And it may be that it's appropriate to increase the punishment for all levels of sex offense. That really is beyond the scope of what our task force is looking at. But keep in mind, there's a different constitutional basis for punishment of someone who's convicted of committing a crime and commitment of someone who you are worried may commit a crime in the future. Get to your second point. If someone commits a felony, even while they're in civil commitment, I believe Commissioner Jessen can speak to this as well, they don't get a pass. They get prosecuted. And if they're prosecuted and their sentence is that they serve time, and they are out of the civil commitment process and back in the criminal commitment. I believe that's how it works. And finally, on your last point, treatment, I think all the professionals agree, can be effective for someone who has a past history of sexual offenses. No criminal who comes out of jail is 100% warranted against recidivism. But treatment can significantly reduce the risk, and that's the goal of the treatment. And there may be some people who simply are not amenable to treatment, and the system will have to deal with them. But I hope that answers your questions. First of all, the criminal sentence that you're talking about is separate from civil commitment, although not unrelated. And if you commit a felony, you're back in the criminal system.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Representative Grunhagen, we're going to go to Chair Liebling and come back to you.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And that's absolutely what the Chief Justice said. And I just wanted to make it really clear. Representative Grunhagen, that issue really has been dealt with over the years. And a lot of the problem we have now with people that are in MSOP is they were convicted and served time under old laws. And I don't have the data here, but there has definitely been an effort over the last several sessions to do that, to tighten up laws so that we don't get this situation where people really who should not have been released are because they were under an old sentence. But I very much agree with the Chief Justice. It's really a separate issue, although it is related. But it's not as though people have looked at that, and we could get more information on that for you. And I would like the Commissioner to comment on this issue about crimes being committed in MSOP.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, when we think a felony has been committed within MSOP, we always make the referral to the county attorney. And I think, and based on my conversations with Representative Hillstrom and others, I think part of her concern was, are those cases always prosecuted in quickly in an appropriate manner? But from our perspective, absolutely, we totally support. If someone commits a felony at MSOP, we want them prosecuted and in the and move to DOC if they're convicted. What I would say is sometimes that happens. They're convicted, they serve their time, and after that, then they come back rather than being released on probation.
Representative Grunhagen, I will come back to you, but we do have others.
Okay, real quick, and then I'm done.
Again, you have a quick response?
Yep, very quick. Just the, I guess just in summary, I would have to see the data or the a bill that would actually put an end to keeping more and more people going into this program. In other words, life without parole for level 3 sex offenders. I'd either have to see a bill or the data that shows, because when they presented it last year in public safety or the year before, it showed enrollment in this program is going to go right through the roof in the future. Okay? So that tells me that it's not life without parole. Okay? Life with no parole. It tells me that these people are getting a shorter sentence and then being put into this expensive and not very effective program. So until I see that type of answer for the safety of the public, it's hard for me to support this. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Well, thank you. And it's been a real honor to serve on the task force. If you ever want to do a master's paper on something, on topic, this is the topic, and that task force is the people to interview. It is just the most august panel I've served on, and Justice Magnuson and Rosenbaum are just stellar leaders, and we've dug in. And just to encourage members today, we have a narrow topic today. We have spent hours and hours, and we spend 3 hours, and we just kind of get going on a topic and go into the details. So I just have that question that I'll ask, but it's courts in, courts out, and there's a pipeline. And we've tried to fix the pipeline. The people coming out are part of the old pipeline, and they've served their time. They were convicted. They did 3 years, 10 years, whatever the time was. And so now, I know we have 600-some people in MSOP, and so what do you do with them? And that's the question. And there's no place to put them. Nobody wants them anywhere. The moon would be fine. And they have constitutional rights. That's the pesky thing about this. They actually are humans and with rights. If maybe the two witnesses could comment, is it just the view of exaggerative pessimists that if we don't do anything, something bad will happen? Some people just hope this goes away, and we have a hard time tackling hard topics. So just in both, you could say, what if we don't do anything? You think nothing will happen, and next year will come and go, and thank you.
Representative Chief Justice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, this is a very real lawsuit in federal court. It started off with the prisoners representing themselves. The court appointed an extremely competent lawyer to represent them, someone who is experienced in these matters. With the history of self-criticism by the state of its own program, the governor's task force, the legislative auditor, and DHS itself, it is far too optimistic and unrealistic to think that there isn't a problem. And with the deadline the court gave our task force to make some recommendations, I think that it is absolutely inappropriate to think that the court isn't going to do something if you don't. I think that there's a very, very real prospect for the federal judge, if you don't take advantage of the big hint he's given you, to just say, well, I gave them their chance and I don't want to do this, but that's what the Constitution requires.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, since I'm the defendant in the lawsuit, if it's okay with you, I'll just let this Chief Justice speak to that one.
Representative Abler.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. It's like a lawyer next to you. That's good. Better than a lawyer, Chief Justice. But as we go forward in the discussion, I would urge members to pay attention to the draft in front of them and say, what does the draft do? Because we'll never get this topic addressed in if we had all day till tomorrow. But I think that this is a responsible approach. I delve into that question. Is it responsible? Is it not? What does it do? What is, with the sexual violence thing is probably pretty vanilla, but what is the commitment discussion? Does anybody get turned loose or not? And what are we proposing? And I think people see it's a responsible way that turns nobody new loose, but just gives a more clear way. And I'm happy to support it. So that'll be a productive way to spend the next bit of time. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Lead Mac.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions, so I'll try to ask them succinctly to not take too much time. I don't know how many people are on the list. But I guess first, just a couple of questions. I've looked through some of the task force materials, and I'm curious, in looking at the court order, and Commissioner Jess and I had a little bit of time to talk about this in the last month. But I guess my question is, with not a lawyer background, the court order seems to be almost an agreement in terms of kind of going agreeing with the plaintiffs, and the task force is a response to that, almost versus a court order or directive. It seems like an agreement of some sort. And I'm just curious, is it maybe to Mr. Magnuson, did the court order, does it strike you as being different than typically how something like this work, or is a task force out of this big of an issue a typical route to go and for the department to take on that from the court? And I guess partly just wondering maybe from the commissioner why the department with something like this, if we felt like we've been in the right all these years. I've sat on this committee for 4 years, and time and time again I'm told these are the worst of the worst. We're treating them, we're following through with what we need to do. And I feel like the way that the department, how we've moved forward with this court order, what seems to be some sort of an agreement moving forward, acknowledges that over the past many, many years, the argument that we've made that these are the worst of the worst, we're almost going back on that, saying, well, maybe we have been over-committing them. Maybe we have been over-punishing them. Maybe, which just seems to be a drastic diversion from what we've been hearing and saying for the past, I don't know how long. So I guess if any comments, and if you could respond to that, I'm trying to get an understanding of this court order and the direction it took us in, and why the department, why we went that direction instead of maybe fought it or fought to defend what we've been doing thus far.
Mr. Chief Justice.
I believe the commissioner would be more appropriate to address that first, because you're asking about the department's actions.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. Let me address first, are these all the worst of the worst? comment, and then was the department fighting this? You know, let me share my perspective, but I think it's also the perspective that's in the, once again, in the legislative auditor's report, reflected in the department's review of this, in its report to the legislature in 2011, and really even in many ways in Governor Pawlenty's task force in 2005. There are many people in this program that are absolutely the worst of the worst. There is no question about that. But there are also people in this program, I think, that are, you know, people are aging in this program. You know, people who, you know, perhaps had, you know, at age 70, it's a different risk than at age 40. There are people in this program who have, who are low functioning. And so I think that there's a variety of people in this program there. But are there some people there that I believe should absolutely never be provisionally discharged because they're not progressing for treatment? Absolutely. But I don't think you can just paint that, you know, everyone in there with the same brush. They're not all the same. And I think that's reflected in the early report. So I don't think that's a difference in what, you know, in what the folks that have looked at these at this population have been saying. I think the other thing is the department is defending against this lawsuit. We're not just saying, oh, whatever you say, Judge. You know, we're defending the state in this lawsuit. Probably why I wasn't going to answer Representative Abler's question a few minutes ago. But this is this court order was part of, I think, trying to address these issues. Courts can make orders we don't agree with. Courts can make orders we do agree with. We are defending the lawsuit. And with that, Mr. Chair, if you don't, with your permission, as I told Representative Liebling earlier, the governor's releasing his supplemental budget in a few minutes, and I need to be there. If I could be excused, and there are experts from the department here who can answer any technical questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to add to that, too, and thank you, Commissioner. And I know you do need to take off, but I just want to say that ever since I've been here and been on Health and Human Service Committees, we've been hearing from the Department of Human Services, the people at MSOP, and we have seen that there's been a problem. I don't think there's anybody who's been here who would say there's no problem. And we've seen the reports that the Commissioner mentioned, and every report we get says there is a problem. Because our numbers are growing and growing, and unfortunately what happened, and we all know this, that there was a tragedy, a very awful murder that was committed by someone who was released from prison some years ago, and that after that very terrible incident, that the numbers of commitments simply started to climb. Now, I think it's really important to keep in mind what the Commissioner said. This is a wide range of people we're talking about. They're not all the same. And what we're proposing to do in the bill is not change the standards for commitment. In fact, I think it could be argued that under what I'm proposing in this bill, you could see more commitments, actually. What I'm aiming for here, and I think what we're all aiming for here, is a real program that seriously tries to say who is a danger and seriously tries to target treatment to those people. With the idea that, as I think the Chief Justice said, that treatment does work for many people. Now, can you eliminate all risk? Of course not. But can any of us say that we're totally safe? You know, I read just this morning a horrible story in the press about a young mother who jumped out a window with her baby in her arms. Terrible story. And what do you see it says in that story? Nobody who knew her ever would have thought that she would have done such a thing. So we all know that in life, that we don't really know. There are risks in life, but there are also ways that we have. There is a certain expertise about trying to figure out who is at risk and trying to appropriately treat and those people, trying to provide appropriate safety measures, restrictions on those that we can figure out, because part of the thrust of my bill, and this is important, members, why I put the other pieces in there, which you're going to hear more about if we get to Representative Loeffler's bill, because she has them in a separate bill, and that's the sexual violence prevention pieces in the bill, because this is a really broad problem, and locking up the 600 people, it does keep us safe from those people. And as the Commissioner said, there are some people in there really who probably should never get out. But there are also many people who probably should be committed and are not. Because the system we have right now forces a judge to make a choice between giving somebody what amounts to a life sentence or doing nothing. And my bill tries to get rid of that terrible choice to say, yes, you can commit someone who meets the standard without giving them a life sentence. Now, people, this was argued on the task force. Some people said, whoa, wait a minute, you may put more people in there. That's a bad thing. And my answer to that is, if they need to be there, I don't care if there are more, because this is really about public safety. But it really also has to be about targeting the resources where they need to go, and not just saying, here are the worst of the worst, and then everybody else just goes and does what they do. We just cannot do that. It doesn't serve public safety.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. And, Mr. Chair.
For now.
And I guess I understand what we're trying to address in this bill, but I do think it's worth noting the horrific case that led to the extreme growth in this program, and that was, you know, the murder by Alfonso Rodriguez. I believe he was on a least restrictive alternative at the time that horrible thing happened. He wasn't committed, and it was later stated that he most definitely should have been. So I think that gives me pause in terms of, you're right, there are unknown risks, and none of us know what people are going to do. But I guess, again, I go back to the experts that we've had in front of this committee who have talked to us over the past many years, and have, you know, simply told us that why these people are being civilly committed is because the judges do weigh the risk, they do hear from the county attorneys, and they deem that the likelihood of these folks reoffending is extremely, extremely high, which is why they haven't been released, or the judge doesn't offer a different option. And I do understand the challenge of the lack of options that judges have, and that's what we're trying to address here. But the one question I have for Mr. Magnuson, I'm wondering just what your thoughts are in terms of when we're in the middle of active litigation and the state is defending itself in this situation, the actions that have been taken. Does it hurt us, or what are the repercussions of us producing a report that is going to almost on behalf of many of the issues that the plaintiffs are raising in this, when we're in the midst of that litigation, does that raise concerns, or does that put the state in a tough position to continue to advocate its position going forward if in the middle of this litigation we're releasing a report basically admitting to many of the problems that the plaintiffs have raised?
Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mack. I'm a little confused about your reference to a report. You enact legislation. My task force makes reports at the direction of the federal court. Is the appointment of a task force in these circumstances unusual? It is. I don't think, frankly, that there's anything that the department could have done to resist the appointment of the task force. The judge has the authority to do that. As far as negative reports hurting the state's position in the litigation, with respect, you've already written them. You have Governor Pawlenty's task force. You have the Office of the Legislative Auditor. They could not be more clear in their criticism and concerns about the current system. It needs to be fixed. I think what the lawsuit has done is it has brought that to a head, because there is now active litigation raising the same issues that are in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report, among others, and saying, Judge, the state's not doing anything. You need to step in under the Constitution. And I think the judge was being respectful of the state. This is just my view. I haven't spoken with him, but my view is he was being respectful of the state, saying, okay, we've got some serious issues. You've already noted them as a state. I'm going to give you a chance to address them before I step in. And so I don't think that enacting legislation hurts you in the litigation. I think it is responsive to issues that you have been faced with for many years prior to the lawsuit. So, you know, I think that it is entirely within the court's purview to appoint our task force. We make recommendations. We don't have any authority to do anything. We are not an arm of the state. But we are yet another voice that says the same thing that you have said, that the state has said.
Lead Mac, I have, I think, eight others. May I move forward? Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the bill itself, and this would, I'm not sure if this would be for Chief Justice or for the author of the bill, but it talks about a strict and intensive supervision and treatment program, and I understand Commissioner Jessen said that she's received 21 responses to requests for what those look like. But I, my concerns go to, as Representative Liebling said, you implored us to trust you. I'm troubled, not for trusting you, but trust on the part of the very individuals that this would affect. Because trust is something that they have to earn, but it also has to be recognized in them by others. And I'm just concerned from a risk management standpoint of whether or not we as a society can bear the risk for being wrong, even once.
Representative Albright, is that a question?
I'll lead to my question. I'm done with my speech then. This would actually go to the point of the treatment program itself, but is there a known rate of recidivism that we can point to for the treatment programs that are already being utilized?
Madam Chair or Chief Justice, who either
well,
of you?
First, maybe the Chief Justice has the figures, the recidivism figures, but I just first like to address the issue about trust me. I think we're talking about two different things here, Representative Albright. Whether when I'm saying trust me, I mean to trust me that this is that I'm working on this very seriously with the stakeholders, taking input from all people who need to be heard, and working on this with public safety as well as constitutionality foremost in mind. And that's what I've tried to do with this bill. This is not a bill about, as the commissioner said, about letting people out. It's a bill about making sure that we have the best public safety we can right now. And it is definitely not a comprehensive bill. There is probably more work that needs to be done. This bill is an attempt to get started so that the federal court will see that we are serious about making this a real treatment program, and that we as a state can show our citizens that what we want to do is make sure that they are as safe as possible. So there are pieces in here that things that haven't really been done before. There is a lot, and I hope we'll get to Representative Loeffler's bill and you'll hear from people who work on this issue, but we are not doing the best job we can for public safety. So what we're proposing here is more options, as the commissioner was saying, but options where the need for public safety will be foremost in people's minds as individuals are considered for a change in status, or whether when they're initially found to meet the criteria for commitment, where their placement would be. And all the experts and the best information would be brought to bear on those decisions. So we are not talking about just saying to somebody, we trust you, walk out the door. In fact, we're doing that a lot now by not having resources to treat people and to restrain people that perhaps we should be. So the trust me part of this is not having anything to do with trusting any offender who is going to go through their process. It has to do with that this is a work in process. There are many issues that we've been talking about that haven't been yet incorporated into the DE. There are a lot of issues that need to be addressed, but I'm working closely with all the stakeholders to try to make this the best bill that it can be without trying to bite off so much this year that we simply can't do anything, which is a lot of what has happened in the past.
Mr. Chief Justice, would you like to add anything, or should we move forward?
I think you need to move, although I would be happy to discuss with Representative Albright directly the issues that he raised.
Representative Ziroz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some basics on kind of what we're talking about, the what do we call this? Strict, what's the wording? Strict
and intensive supervision. And
strict and intensive supervision, also known as least restrictive. I'm wondering, as we talk about strict and intensive supervision as the least restrictive alternative, what does this look like? It's a little vague, and so I'm picturing, are we talking about GPS monitoring, supervised release, or is that kind of what we're the path we're going down?
I'm sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Zerwas. I'm not saying that the SIST is a least restrictive alternative. What we're trying to do here, without knowing exactly what the options are yet, because you heard the commissioner say that she's still in the preliminary phase of trying to see what's available, but absolutely it could involve GPS monitoring. It could involve a range of options. And one of the things I've learned in this is that part of the treatment that people go through involves learning to function in settings that are less and less restrictive under careful monitoring. So I think we all have seen this, you know, in a prison movie. One of my favorite prison movies, what's that that film about the guy who digs the tunnel and escapes from prison?
There's I love that movie.
Shawshank
Redemption. Thank you. There's a piece in there about a prisoner who comes out, and this idea that they come out after many, many years, and they're so shocked by and so feel so uncomfortable that they do something to go back in. So there is this thing that people need to learn to function in society sometimes, and in order to, so part of the treatment to make it real has to be, you know, learning to cook for yourself, learning to monitor your own reactions so that if you find yourself getting into trouble, you get help before you get into trouble. Those kinds of things. So without an ability to move through some phases, there really can't be any real treatment, and that's part of the dilemma we're in. But yes, it's intended that it be, that the safety risk be absolutely attended to in any setting that would be outside of the most secure walls.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, I have a lot of people on the list. I will call back to you. I'm going to be a dictator here today.
If I could just do a follow-up.
If it's very short, because your colleagues have good questions. By the way, everyone should come up with the very best question they can, because we are limited in our time and we have other bills we need to hear.
Well, and I thank you for indulging me. I think Shawshank Redemption is a feel-good movie about an unjust prisoner being saved. We're talking about sexual psychopaths that are sexually attracted, in many cases, to very young and small children. Couldn't be further from your favorite prison movie. I spent 5 years in the Anoka County Sheriff's Office in their crime lab investigating these types of crimes. I helped put together a background investigation to pull together evidence on a civil commitment hearing that went forward in Anoka County. I don't think equating that to someone learning to cook for themselves out there. These are people that are sexually attracted to children. And it was said earlier that some of these people are 70 years old. There are a lot of 65, 70, 75-year-old individuals charged with criminal sexual conduct. They're very unassuming, and children especially trust older adults. And so we can say we're going to monitor them, and we're going to GPS them, but you're not with them. They're not behind razor wire. They are in the community. It's not Shawshank Redemption.
All right, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, Representative Zerwas, I'm sorry, that was a little flip. I just was simply using that movie as an example of how people need to learn to come out of confinement sometimes. That's all. I am in no way, obviously that was a movie that had nothing to do with sex offenders. And you're right, some people absolutely need very close and careful monitoring. But going back to what the commissioner said, everybody is not the same. And the bottom line is, if we are saying, oh, can't treat anybody, can't trust anybody, then the court is going to say, then you don't have a treatment program, and this is not constitutional. So there's the dilemma that we're in. None of us think it's okay for people to abuse kids. You know, let's just get that out there. None of us think that it's just safe to release these people to walk around free. But let me just tell you that that is happening right now. And we need to do a better job. And by just saying, we're just going to keep these 600 locked up and keep adding to them, that is not going to do the job for us. Not in this situation anymore.
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Liebling, for bringing this forward. I know I was served on this committee last time, and I do understand that we do have a problem. My question is just a couple questions, a real practical. The strict and intensive supervision and treatment program, that this is an effort to move people out of MSOP and place them into the community. Is that right?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, it's an attempt to provide treatment options along with good security so that we can show the court that we're not just locking people up and throwing away the key, and that this is a real treatment program. Now, as the commissioner said, as everyone recognizes, there are people who will never, in fact, progress enough to move one inch outside of the walls. But there are people, if there's nobody in there who can ever progress that far, then we don't have a real treatment program. And then we're in real trouble.
Representative Lohmer, you have a second question, real quickly?
Yeah, I guess if they were to be found to be able to be into the community and somehow, just with what you said, where would the state place these people, and how would you determine neighborhoods and things like that? Have you thought about that?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lohmer, that is very much what the commissioner is struggling with, and this is really broad authorizing language, and that we simply don't have the answer yet. I know there's a real concern and interest in seeing that they're not all concentrated in one place, but we need to make sure that whatever facilities we have are secure enough and have the appropriate treatment and monitoring capabilities. So it's a little bit, one of the things we are, I don't know if it's in this draft, but we're planning to have the effective date out a ways so that we can be sure to have things in place before we ever need to use them. But we do need to be moving on this in order to give that lead time and let the court know that we are serious about this so that we can avoid having a solution imposed on us.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Liebling, Chief Justice, when did the, give me a rough date when the federal court said that, gave us the, what I'll call the warning.
Mr. Chief Justice.
How long ago was that?
Oh, I believe it was, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shaw, I believe that the order, which I have here someplace, was in July or August. It took some while to get the task force together. We began meeting in October or September. Actually, I have all on our website, we have the order and we have all of our meeting minutes, and I could find that for you.
So roughly around...
Representative is satisfied.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, so I have kids. My kids understand when I say, when I start counting to three. Whether it's out loud or I do, or I count by hand and show them the numbers on my hand, and I think we're at one right now. And I agree with Representative Zerwas. The things I've seen in the job I do, just like you have, there are, I'm a relatively low-key, mellow fella, but when it comes to these folks, there are unspeakable and unimaginable things that I would absolutely be willing to do to them to prevent them from hurting other people. And I wish we could do that, but we can't. And we don't have a choice. We're opening up a floodgate of responsibility to the state in a bad way if we don't take action. And we can talk about the lingering turmoil related to the Minnesota Gang Strike Force, because the state gave them, you know, we told them they were doing okay, and then all of a sudden, no, they're not doing okay. DVS, innocuous information is viewed. And when I say innocuous information, you get your name, date of birth, and your home address. It's not like your Social Security number, and we are torn apart by that right now. And that's going to cause us some financial implications. This, if we don't act and do something and start to make changes and just pretend that it's not happening like we have for years, is going to be a disaster like any of those have ever been. Thank you.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back to the commissioner's comment that she had 21 folks have contacted her with 21 ideas. I too have an idea, and the history behind my idea is this: that in my nursing life, years ago, we had patients who were had committed murder and sexual acts, and they were elderly, and we cared for them, believe it or not, in the nursing home. And then we had Aqua Ching, and then as time and the behaviors got worse, there were procedures taken in our county to send a couple of those folks to Aqua Ching, and I believe that's now gone. That's gone by the wayside. That was a good facility. So we've actually lost a good facility. What if, and I just want to put this out there, regional treatment centers for, the worst of the worst, you're going to have to keep where they are forever. And then I read in the Minneapolis Tribune about some young people who had offended and who have the behaviors of and are receiving treatment, and they're not sure if the treatment, or even if they're partaking in their treatment. You can't force people to take the treatment, but you can move them out if they're after a certain amount of time. So there are evaluations in your bill in place, a yearly evaluation of whether or not, moving along, and they're taking advantage of what's offered to them to help them. And if it's not working, then they stay. So there, and then I think for those that are probably aging out and also may meet some criteria. What about regional treatment centers that are less expensive that would house them, and it'd be a different type of care?
Representative,
has that been considered?
Well, thank you, Representative Fritzen. I think the commissioner is considering all options, and I have no doubt that she will come back to us when she has more information and is able to make specific proposals, because obviously these are things that will need to be funded. And so I think you can be sure that she will keep our committees in the loop on this.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Chairman, that is one thing that I just wanted to get on record. Those are some thoughts and experience that I've had, and that I thought we could probably look at. And it is expensive, but it is an expensive program. There's no doubt about it. That's why we're discussing it. Part of the reason is why we're discussing it, and it's a serious situation for all of us. We have not released anyone. No one's out into society scot-free, correct?
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. And the one person that was out was revoked, and is that correct?
Representative Liebling.
Is there anyone out now?
Well, there is somebody, as I understand right now, Representative Fritz, on conditional release, but not just out, not on full release. Mm-hmm. But there is one person who, I believe there was one before who then violated and was mm-hmm. taken back. Mm-hmm. But maybe the Chief Justice can confirm that, but that's my understanding. Essentially, nobody's been fully released.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to find out.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, let me just open up by saying that I am a mother of 7 kids and a grandmother of 2 small children with 2 on the way. And so I am a huge believer that we want to keep our streets safe. And there's many other factors that live with every day that makes me even more prompt to say that we want to always have safe communities. So in saying that, what I think I'm hearing here and why this bill is before us is that we have individuals who have been convicted of heinous crimes. And one, they're at Moose Lake, where we're paying over $100,000 to house one person. We're just housing them. We're not doing anything else. We're not treating them, you know, no good outcomes, $100,000. And so what I'm hearing is that, you know, how do we put some secure, and the biggest part of this is that I've heard that what we're doing is that people have been convicted of a crime and then have served their time and been released to Moose Lake forever. It is unconstitutional. It is unconstitutional. We don't get to pick and choose what part of the Constitution that we want to validate based on our values and what we care about. It is unconstitutional. So before us is, how do we become in line with our Constitution? And how do we do that in a way that we are putting secure mechanism in place that keeps us safe and hopefully has some savings that is sustainable and, again, keeps us safe? We're not saying here we want to release people into the community in an unsafe manner, but we have to abide by our Constitution and do it in a way that is going to keep us safe and secure. And so what I'm hearing is that how do we do this transition? How we do it in a way that's more effective, cost-effective, more, and that is secure, that is about treatment, that is about monitoring. And just for clarification, is this not a bill about how do we transition and go in line with our Constitution?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Representative Brand. And clearly, the axe is hanging over our head. And we don't know if the court is going to actually say that this is unconstitutional. We aren't at that point yet. But given what we know about the law and about the lawsuit, we are concerned that that could happen. So, and it is, I do believe that as legislators, we have a responsibility to interpret the Constitution ourselves and act in accordance with that. We all take an oath to uphold the state constitution and the federal constitution. And so we can't just wait for the courts to tell us what that means. We also have to, I believe, exercise independent judgment. And I do believe that what we're doing in our current program is not constitutional, and we should act with it before the court makes us act.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think we all want to make sure that we do this responsibly and assure public safety as we go along. But I think from what I've learned in looking at the background materials and talking with people who have been involved in this, I think what we also have to acknowledge is that we may have, out of fear, cast the net wider an MSOP than maybe is justifiable in terms of amenity to treatment and ability to rehab. And I have heard and looked at documents that have said that actually this group that is a pretty big group includes the worst of the worst who may never be able to make it past that yearly review in terms of their ability to progress on treatment. But it also includes others who are on a broader scheme. And I have heard that sex offenders are not more likely to reoffend than other types of serious felony offenders, or that the perception that they are all totally just, you know, incapable of self-control or rehabilitation is false. And is that the impression that you've had looking at the research on this?
Representative Liebling or Mr. Chief Justice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, we had a presentation at our task force, the meeting before last, on that very topic. Treatment is effective. Treatment does significantly reduce recidivism rates. Not all people are amenable to treatment, but the recidivism rate, as I recall, and this is a vague recollection, we can provide you with the specifics, is about the same for a treated sex offender as it is for any other felon who has gone through rehabilitation. So it can be effective.
Representative Loeffler.
And Mr. Chair and members, I also recall in past years getting information about how a significant powder, the people who are in this facility, are people who have developmental disabilities, who are low functioning, who unfortunately are oftentimes reenacting things that were done to them, and who may be operating on instinct and who are maybe difficult to get through treatment because of their functioning level, but who, from my perspective, if you're developmentally disabled, were bullied or horribly victimized as a child, and have an inability to go to treatment, I think putting them in a different type of secure facility without people who are of normal or above normal intelligence who can prey on them, to me, also seems like a responsible way to go. And I don't know, I think that it's important for us to acknowledge, as we're trying to figure out how to deal with this population, that we have some people there who I think are really vulnerable to being mixed in with a different population, and I think that's one of the alternatives we should look at. And I hope the task force will look at that, and the commissioner, as they look at alternatives, because those people really are in a different circumstance than I think some of the people that have been portrayed. And I think we really, as a state, need to look out for protecting vulnerable people who are incapable of maybe going through the treatment process because of their functioning level.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, want to thank the committee, the task force, for doing all the work that you have done and for the thoughtful questions and comments that everyone has been making. I know everybody's taking this very seriously. Years ago, I worked in, I think we called it a halfway house, working with people coming out of an institution, very much as you describe, not having life skills, basic life skills. And I think we keep referring to the judge only has A or B or A or Z, and there's nothing in between, and we're trying to think about something being in between. The place I was working at was a secure facility. You had no opportunity to get out unless you were allowed to, escorted or whatever. And it just seems to me, especially after Representative Fritz and Representative Loeffler's comments, that we could come up with those facilities, whether they're regional or not. You know, those are the little things. But for us to have a picture of those transitional places that would give judges the options to place someone more appropriately, and they could go up or down depending on how they did in that particular setting, but to give people the opportunity to have a little more normal life, even if and treatment, even if they actually never did leave, there would be less expense associated with those less restrictive but still confined facilities.
Thank you. I have two more, Representative Zerwas and Representative Mack, and after that I'm going to move for a vote. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Chair Liebling. I guess one of the concerns that I have in going through this, and you articulated, is that this is fairly broad authorizing language being proposed in front of us, with the idea that, you know, there's 21 things that have been proposed to the commissioner, but the commissioner has to decide what options are. I'm really uncomfortable with passing such significant changes with such a broad authorizing bill that, depending on what conditions and restrictions the commissioner decides to or not to impose on this population, will control their behaviors. So I'm going to ask, paint a picture for me. I mean, what? I don't know what the 21 conditions are. We talked maybe about GPS, and so if we have someone that is eligible to be released, and they're released in Rochester, what does it look like? Is it a group home? Is it a secure facility? Is it an apartment? What's their day look like? What's their week look like?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I think that's a very legitimate question. One thing you need to understand is that right now we have sex offenders living in every community under various degrees of restriction, sometimes none. So what we're talking about here is not the commissioner deciding what conditions anybody would be under. This is about courts deciding that. And so in the bill, even though the bill needs, there are things that I know we're going to change that we just didn't get time to get in here, and I'm working with county attorneys and others to do that to make sure this is very tight. But it is not the commissioner who's going to decide this. In fact, I really think the commissioner needs to be out of the process, because this process needs to be depoliticized. This process needs to be based on expertise and law enforcement and people who understand security risks and so on, and not somebody who's going to be swayed by politics. That's been a lot of our problem around this, so I just want to make sure that you understand that this is a court-driven process where county attorneys will have the opportunity to come in and say, no, 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 this person needs this and this and this condition. But it's not a one-size-fits-all, so I can't give you a picture of what it would look like. I can just tell you that the people who are responsible now would remain responsible for making these decisions.
Lead Mac.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a brief comment or response to Representative Moran. And I know we don't have time today, Mr. Chair, but I know the comment was made. We spend about $100,000 a year to house these individuals. And I think she said that that doesn't include treatment, and we get, you know, nothing for that. I believe in the materials I've looked at, that does include, that is partly why it's so expensive, that much more to keep them in civil commitment versus incarcerated, because of the extremely expensive treatment, the money we spend on psychologists and psychiatrists and the experts that we keep there 24/7 for these folks. So we've invested a great deal of money over the past decade and more per year per person, because there is intensive treatment. That, again, I just think we need to be a little bit careful here today, because I've heard several members say, refer to keeping these people for life and things like that. And I think we've all operated under the assumption treatment is the goal of this program. To say it's not or it hasn't been gets us in the constitutional problem that we could potentially find ourselves in. So I believe it is constitutional. We are treating these folks, I think, correctly identifying what the problem is, and I can't say that I've heard that spoken to other than the fact that we're keeping people for too long and they're not getting out. But I've been told for years that we're treating these people with what's been proven or thought to be very effective and revamped. We've heard from very impressive psychologists. So I guess I haven't necessarily been convinced today of what specifically the problem is, other than we're under threat from the federal courts. And, one other thing, the commissioner said this does nothing to change the terms for civil commitment. And I understand it's still courts in, courts out, but it does, in fact, change the procedure for civil commitment. I mean, it says that line, or that this report will talk about the civil commitment procedure changes on line 4.30. And so, Chair Liebling, I don't envy the position you're in. I know that this is a very tough issue, and I would be happy. I'd love to talk or maybe hear from the MSOP folks, maybe in the next hearing, or I can connect with them down the road. The same folks that have championed the treatment that they are trying to put into effect that makes this program constitutional, and kind of get their take on that. But at this point, it's difficult for me to support this going forward. I just can't say that I've been convinced of that this is absolutely the right thing forward for the state of Minnesota and our citizens. So, and Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call, please.
A roll call has been called, and roll call will be held.
Well, Mr. Chair.
But before we get to that issue, let's hear from Representative Liebling first.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Mack, by asking for roll call, you are scuttling this bill, and it will be really clear who's doing that, because I'm not going to put, as I said at the outset, this has to be a non-political issue. Now, I pledged you that I'll continue to work on the language, but if you're sitting here today saying there's no problem, then that's the answer that's going to the federal court. So I just want you to be really clear about that, because I'm going to lay over the bill rather than have a roll call vote, because this needs to be bipartisan. And by having a roll call, members are going to, if we're going to go that route, the bill is going to stop. So I just really want to make that clear, that you should be fully aware of that. So if you're so sure that this is constitutional and that the court is going to find it so, you have put yourself on record on that, and I'm going to lay the bill over. So, you know, it's kind of your choice, Representative Mack. I will have done what I can do.
Representative Mack, will you reconsider so that the bill can continue to Judiciary Committee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I hear you say wanting to work on some of the issues that remain in the bill, and would like to work on that with you. So with that, I'll remove the roll call.
Thank you. Do you have any other comments you'd like to make before I call for the vote?
Thank you very much. Members, I really appreciate the very respectful discussion. And this is a hugely complex issue. That's why the task force has spent so much time. That's why we've had so many reports. This is not easy to solve. And I am in no way pretending that we're actually going to solve all the issues this year in this bill. But I do think that we need to move forward and show the court at least that we're making some effort and show our citizens that we're making some effort. We need to do some of the other pieces that are in this bill as well, the statewide task force, which hopefully you're going to hear about from Representative Loeffler, and show that we're not just about the little line on the postcard, but we're about real public safety and looking at the broad range of risk, not just the people who are in MSOP, but taking this whole topic very seriously for the benefit of all of our citizens and trying to prevent future victims. That's really what this is all about. So with that, members, I just ask you to support the bill so that it can move forward. We can continue to work on this.
With that, Representative Liebling renews her motion that House File 1139 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
Passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Committee, we're going to continue and begin hearing Representative Loeffler's bill, House File 1125, and we'll go a little bit late on that.
Representative Loeffler, thank you very much for your patience. Members, before we proceed, we need to reconsider action on House File 1114.
Madam Chair, I'll make that motion.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Ms. Representative Abler moves to reconsider House File 1114. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion carries. The bill is back before us, and Representative Abler.
Madam Chair, I move to delete Article 5.
All right. Representative Abler moves to delete Article 5. And
part you didn't like.
Representative Abler, I'm going to ask for a roll call on that motion. Okay, wait. We're going to delete. Okay, this is in, let's see. This is to delete, is this the amendment? No. Okay, so are we going to, Matthew? Okay. So, members, what we're doing here is deleting Article 5 in House File 1114, and that was the section that had to do with the set-asides for people who are have committed crimes that prevent them from being certified to perform services under DHS. So this is a bill that passed last hearing. And there was a problem with that section, and Representative Abler is the author of that bill, and that is why he's moving to delete that. So we're going to do we are going to take a roll call on deleting that section.
Chair Liebling?
Aye.
Vice Chair Moran?
Aye.
Lead Representative Mack? Representative Abler?
Yes.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Allen? Representative Benson?
Aye.
Representative Franson? Representative Fritz? Representative Grunhagen? Representative Huntley? Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Lohmer?
No.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Mullery?
Aye.
Representative Schoen?
Aye.
Representative Schumacher?
Aye.
Representative Ward?
Aye.
Representative Zerwas?
Madam Chair?
Representative Albright?
Wait,
let's announce the vote.
Oh, he wants the change.
Oh.
No, I don't. I'm just asking for...
Then let's wait until we tally the vote. There being 11 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails, and the amendment is passed. So, members, we're going to repass the, or take another vote now on repassing the bill as amended. So, Representative Abler now moves that House File 1144 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Right? That's where it's going. So, all those in favor, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Okay. All right, we're going to move to Representative Loeffler's. I'm sorry, Representative Albright, I forgot to call on you. Did you want, still want to have a question? Okay.
I just, a little bit surprised by not receiving information about the amendment or the bill itself before we took a roll call on it. I'm just wondering if that's proper and customary.
Well, Representative Albright, the bill is still before the committee. And so when a bill is still before the committee, you can still take action on it. So,
Madam Chair, just
Representative Abler.
This is probably something that people don't understand. The when a committee passes a bill, there's a committee report that gets prepared. The chair signs the committee report. It's then turned into the House, and then the bill is moved on the floor from the committee to the next committee. Before that happens, the bill is still in the possession of the committee. And the motion was not made on the floor to pass it. In fact, the chair held the committee report in her own possession. That's why the bill was still before us. And I made known to my staff that this would be reconsidered today. The roll call was unknown to me, just so everybody knows. So, thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on now to Representative Loeffler's bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move that House File 1125 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance, and I have an A1 amendment.
Okay.
The A1 amendment basically takes out the part dealing with education and the task force. The task force is in the bill that we just acted on, and we'll go to the right committees with that, and the education issues are being dealt with in a different way. So this just focuses the bill on the pilot grants on sexual violence prevention.
Okay. So Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment. Is there any further discussion to the amendment? Questions to the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. So
thank you, members.
Your bill is amended.
I am delighted after spending so much serious time seriously discussing how to treat and respond to people who have committed serious offenses to refocus our discussion on investment in prevention. because right now, while we spend tremendous millions of dollars adjudicating, prosecuting, and incarcerating people who have violated our sexual mores and found guilty, we do invest some in helping victims, but maybe not enough. But we right now don't invest anything in terms of general fund money into prevention and resources for primary prevention of sexual violence, and I always strongly believe that we should prevent where we can. Unfortunately, sexual violence is much more prevalent in our society than any of us want to are comfortable acknowledging. A 2007 report from the Department of Health on the cost of sexual violence said that more than 61,000 Minnesota residents were estimated to be sexually assaulted annually, with about a little less than a third of those, 17,562 of those, being minors under age 18. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention in 2011 estimated that 22% of Minnesota women have been raped in their lifetime. And more than 48% of Minnesota women have experienced sexual violence other than rape, with a significant amount initially assaulted as children or teens. And the data on male assaults, obviously, is we do know that it is not limited to one gender in any way. There's a sense that it may be less reliable in terms of the statistics just because we still have even more shaming about surrounding male victims of sexual assault. And so those numbers are less reliable, that we think, than the surveys that have been done of women, where there's more of a societal support for the victim. And with that, I'd like you to briefly hear from Dana Dunn, who's with MnCASA, and who can provide more context on this subject.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, and Representative Loeffler. I'd like to also thank you for carrying this. Members of the committee, my name is Donna Dunn. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. We are a statewide organization representing nearly 70 community-based sexual assault advocacy programs in the state. And we advocate for a balanced response to sexual violence in Minnesota that includes attention to prevention, intervention, responsive criminal justice system. I'd also like to say I do serve as a member of the Sex Offender Civil Commitment Task Force and have been studying the issue that you just talked about, and would like to say briefly about that we are very supportive of the direction that the bill which was just introduced and voted on is taking us. We know that it's a first step. There is a lot more that has to be done. But I do appreciate the thoughtful conversation you just had about that. I would like to describe a little bit about the community-based sexual violence, and I also like to say child sexual abuse prevention demonstration partnership grants. And I agree with Representative Loeffler that the attention to the primary prevention of sexual violence has got to be on the front burner for all of us. If we do not start focusing our attention and resources and our energy and our best thinking in that direction, we will continue to be back here year after year after year talking about the $73 million it takes to house annually civilly committed offenders, the cost of investigating, prosecuting, incarcerating, and providing post-incarceration supervision to offenders. That is all important, and we're trying to do our best job with public policy in handling that, but in fact, we need to start investing and showing leadership around the primary prevention of sexual violence and child sexual abuse. What these demonstration partnership grants would do is build on the very successful work that we have done at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault to support multidisciplinary teaming around the criminal justice response to incidents of sexual violence. We have become known as a national leader in helping community teams form a better, more consistent, and a more victim-centered response through the criminal justice process. And the fact that that collaborative process works so well in that arena is what brought us to suggesting that we need to work and we need to support community teams collaboratively coming together to say, how can our community work forward to address prevention? We believe in this process, and we also know that the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention has also identified that current opinions view that community mobilization strategies are a well-founded and state-of-the-art approach for effective prevention delivery. So that's one of the things that we are working on. I'd like to say that we have two sort of preliminary teams that are functioning now in Minnesota. We receive some federal funding through the Office of Justice Programs and are supporting a prevention team in Winona and a prevention team in Bemidji who are just starting to work on this process. But this is too small a beginning. We need to, in fact, enhance this work. And those teams are only about 7 months into the process. They are just beginning. This bill then proposes to expand these efforts and to make this the first focus of investing state general fund dollars in preventing sexual violence and child sexual abuse. The appropriation that we would need to move forward with this is something that will be discussed over time, I am sure. But even if we only funded three sites, and what we are proposing is $40,000 per site, even if we only funded three sites, that would equal the amount that we are paying for hosting, for having one offender at the MSOP program for an entire year. So we think this is a cost-effective way of addressing and enhancing community leadership around primary prevention of sexual violence. We really are urging a serious look at this so that we can start investing in prevention rather than focusing most of our public policy investment, as well as our public policy discussion on solving the problem long after the harm has been done. MNCAS is in the midst of its strategic planning process right now, and we have been gathering data from many, many sources in Minnesota. And the one thing that we have heard overwhelmingly is that we need to continue to lead the charge to address prevention and to make prevention a reality. I believe it's very important for this committee to be considering a prevention-based strategy, and we are very welcoming of bringing this issue into the policy focus, into the public policy discussion in the state of Minnesota. I'm asking at this point for the committee's support to advance this initiative forward so that we can start taking some strategic and strong steps in the direction of preventing child sexual abuse and sexual violence. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Madam Chair. With that, we'd be glad to answer any questions.
Right.
I know the time
thank
is short.
Thank you very much, Representative Loeffler and Ms. Dunn. Are there questions from members? Representative Moran and then Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Loeffler, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forth. I have to be honest, I am really a person who really support prevention and looking at how we can create better outcomes by investing early in the process. I also would like to bring some clarity to my statement around Moose Lake and the fact that we're paying over $100,000 to house offenders, and we're not getting any results. So I guess what I meant in that statement is that I'm a person that looks at impacts and outcomes, and the fact is that if we're paying over $100,000 and we're saying that there's no improvement in any of the offenders, then we need to, again, look at how we can have other options as to how we can get people to treatment to be at a better place to re-enter society or move to another secure location. And I think competition is good for what we need to do. So I just want to be clear that it's not to say that Moose Lake has not provided treatment of the utmost, but maybe the outcomes have not been the best results. But so I guess my question for the testifier is, in looking at how we can go forward, maybe if she can address this, as we look at the offenders who are currently located at Moose Lake, who have been there with no avenue to transition out of that location, how can some of these programs benefits some of those offenders, if possible.
Madam Chair and
Representative Law.
And Representative Moran, I'll just handle that because this is really primary prevention. This is to help people who may have not get to the point where they're actually adjudicated and sent to the level of care and treatment that they would need at MSOP. It may be with people who have shown an assaultive behavior, for example, towards a person in their life. And we know violence in domestic abuse situations and other situations often escalates. And so it's helping the community better prepare and, you know, address things in a preventative way. And so I just want to make sure that you know that the focus is really about people pre-adjudication or people who are early on that continuum of offenses and we feel are at risk of escalating if there is an appropriate intervention.
So, members, just excuse me for interrupting. We have Representative Lohmer. We have to be out of this room at noon. And we have another bill with testimony waiting, which, and I think what we're going to do, members, is we're looking for a room. We're going to meet again this afternoon at 3:30 just to hear Representative Hortman's bill. And I apologize, it is deadline week. She had a lot of testifiers come, and we have gone way beyond, mostly my fault, I know. But So I just want to put that out there. So, members, if we can be brief in our questions and our responses, and we can get this bill voted on because we do have to be out of here. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know me. I'm always very brief. So.
You are. Thank you.
I guess I'm just curious, Representative Liebling. I know that the Health Department already has the Sexual Violence Prevention Program led by Patty Wetterling. So can you help me understand the difference between what you're doing here and what is happening there? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll let our witness address that.
Chair Liebling and Representative. The Minnesota Department of Health Sexual Violence Prevention Program is actually, it serves as a place where leadership for the kinds of action that needs to happen in Minnesota is established. So the Minnesota Department of Health doesn't itself engage in prevention programming at the community level, but really they developed the 5-year plan, which is a plan intended for communities, individuals, businesses, community leaders, state leaders to act on. In fact, they serve more of a planning function than an implementing program function.
Okay. Representative Lohmer, anything more? Okay. Thank you. Other questions from members? All right. Seeing none, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 11... Get the right number here. House File 1125 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have 5 minutes where we're not going to be able to take up the next bill. I apologize to the people who are here, but we will meet at 3:30 in room 400 South. And members are very busy today, and so we're gonna stand in recess. We'll meet at 3:30 in room 400 South. We will take up the remaining bill, House File 848, that's on our agenda. And we're going to move that bill very quickly, members, and I do want to tell the testifiers, and I appreciate that you've all come here today, and I do apologize. We're in this time crunch at the end of our deadlines here, but... We will still be wanting to hear the bill very briefly and give members a chance to ask questions. So just if you can all kind of plan accordingly. So we stand in recess until 3:30 this afternoon. Thank you, members. Yeah, we will come to order. And since Representative Hortman is not on the committee, I will move that House File 848 be recommended to pass and go to the Civil Law Committee. Correct, Representative Hortman? Yes, and I have already let folks know that we're most apologetic that they had to hang around all day. But Representative Hortman, so even though we're not on quite as tight a timeline as we were previously, and I think in view of the fact that your folks have been here, I think if we
gave about 10 minutes to each side and then have 10 minutes for questions, hopefully, that because members, of course, have plenty to take care of this evening. But please go ahead and introduce your bill.
There is an amendment to the bill to get the bill in the shape I would like. I understand that the advocates for the bill work with the Department of Health to address some concerns that were raised by the Department of Health. And if the amendment were adopted, it is my understanding that the Department of Health is neutral on the bill.
Okay. And Representative Hortman, is that the 0222?
I believe so, Madam Chair.
Okay. That is in the packet. Do you believe so? You want to make sure so we don't adopt the wrong amendment?
I have a feeling the page will come.
Nope. You are.
Boom. That just happened.
Did you want to take a look at it?
Being early at it, but
there's one behind you.
You just walk around and do that all the time.
Is that yours?
What? What just happened?
Yes.
Yes. Thank
you for voting pro life.
Okay, so Representative Hortman moves the
I appreciate it.
The 0222 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to have it discussed. All those in favor of that amendment, please say.
Madam Chair, I can't make the motion either.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm making it for you. I'm making it for you. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say relatively little about the bill because I think the advocates who are here can speak to it much better than I can. This bill is about making original birth certificates available to adults. In the state of Minnesota, when you're an adult, you're 18 years old, and you go and you request your birth certificate. If you have been adopted, you will not get your actual birth certificate. You will get a fake birth certificate with false information on it, and you will not have any indication on that document that the information is not true. And I think that adults have a right to have information about themselves known to themselves, and that is what the bill does. Madam Chair, I'd like to call my first testifier.
Please. Welcome to the committee, and just please give us your name.
Good evening. My name is James Hamilton. I'm an attorney and an adoptive father, and I'm here today in both capacities to ask this committee to approve H48 as just amended and send it on as requested by Representative Portman. I know the time is short, so I'll abbreviate my testimony. I understand that the representative has circulated my written testimony. Is that correct?
I circulated Kate Vincent Bobo's testimony.
All right. I have copies of my full written testimony here.
Okay. The page will hand that out. Please go ahead.
All right. As an adoptive father, I've spent a considerable amount of time over the last 20 years educating myself on the issues that adoptees and their families face, both biological and adoptive. And it was early in that process that I first learned of the existence of sealed birth certificates. Frankly, it had never occurred to me when I adopted my son that the original record of his birth might be sealed away by the state forever. As an attorney, the idea of sealed records appalled me. I just could find no possible justification for treating an adult adoptee any differently than any of the rest of us in this room or in the state of Minnesota. In my view, no one should have the right to tell the state whether my son may have access to his information. Yet our current law and the failed to act in 2008 placed that right in the hands of the man and the woman who conceived him, merely because he had been adopted after he was born. Some contend that adoptees should not have unconditional access to their original birth certificates because birth parents were in some way promised that their identities would be forever secret. Yet no Minnesota statute in the past 100 years has ever made that kind of promise. Only two courts in this country have ever been asked to rule on that proposition, and both have held to the contrary. They've said no. Statutes which provided for sealing of records were not guarantees of privacy forever. They were subject to change if the legislature deemed it an appropriate thing to do. I've cited in my written testimony the two decisions to which I just referred along with the citations, including internet citations, if you wish to review those. Now, some will say that Minnesota law is different because we have, in the relatively recent past, permitted a birth parent to direct the state not to disclose a birth certificate. I will address that point in a moment, but first let's consider the argument about privacy rights. I think we can all agree that a right is something that is universal. Either we all have it, or if we don't all have it, it's not a right. If only some of us are given permission to do certain things, then it is a privilege. And the state has created a privilege in certain birth parents, permitting them to essentially direct the state to withhold release of original birth certificates. The state has the power to change policy and to eliminate that privilege. And that's what this bill seeks to do. We see privileges modified by the legislature every year, whether it's changing the age and conditions under which one may drive a car, buy an alcoholic beverage, or qualify for various government programs. You may also hear claims that those who have exercised their statutory privilege to prevent disclosure of an original birth certificate have obtained some kind of vested interest in non-disclosure, and that retroactive extinction of that privilege would violate Minnesota and United States constitutions. Those arguments can be made, but it's important for you to know that at this point in time, it is solely an argument. No court in this country has ever considered that exact question. There is absolutely no legal guidance to rely on in that regard. I will not waste your time going into specific arguments on that issue. I'll only say that, in my opinion, the issue is far too complex and the outcome in the case far too uncertain for this committee or the legislature to attempt to forecast what our courts will do. And that it's the legislature's job to establish the public policy and the court's job to determine whether the legislature's policy decisions have infringed on any right held by any individual. Okay. As an adoptive father and an attorney, I ask you to approve H.F.848 as amended and to send it on as requested. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Let's take the other testifiers, and then we're all here pretty closely together, and if members have questions, I'm sure that we can get the testifiers back. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chair and members. My name is Penelope Needham. I'm an adoptee. I represent the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform. It's a nonpartisan group of adoptees, birth parents, adoptive parents, adoption professionals, and others touched by adoption. We're volunteers trying to reform adoption law in Minnesota so that all Minnesota-born adoptees would have access to their own original birth certificate at age 18 without needing parental permission. There are four main problems adoptees have with the current Minnesota law and access for original birth certificates. First, the adoptee is the subject of the vital record collected by the state, our factual birth certificate. Yet, as the subject, many of us are denied access to that record. Two, the denial of access was made by an affirmation or declaration of a relinquishing parent after their parental rights had been terminated. This is called the affidavit of non-disclosure. Third problem, the affidavit or implied contract to deny the adoptee's right to receive their own original birth certificate was made without the adoptee's consent, representation, or even a guardian ad litem. And finally, the process to that adoptees need to go through to receive their original birth certificate is complicated, time-consuming, costly, and still may not guarantee the release of the original birth certificate to the adoptee. I think you have a copy in your packet of the current process. It's a flowchart, and it will show that
where you start, the waiting periods. Sometimes you can alleviate that by paying for a search at an adoption agency and getting your records if they can obtain a parental permission. Sometimes you have to go and apply in the court system, but you have to show just cause if you do that. Or you can wait until you're 100 years old when the records become public. And those are the options for an adopted person. The best interest of the child has always been at the center of adoption. Current adoption best practices encourage openness and truth and recognizes of the fundamental need of everyone to know who they are and where they come from. 95% of all domestic adoptions in Minnesota are considered open, with some knowledge or contact between the adoptee and the birth parents or the adoptive families and birth families. Access to original birth certificates is supported by not only the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, but by the Child Welfare League of America, the American Adoption Congress, Concerned United Birth Parents, North America Council on Adoptable Children, among others. Minnesota law needs to catch up. 9 other states, including Oregon, Maine, New Hampshire, and the latest Rhode Island in 2012, have restored adoptees' access to their original birth certificates. And Kansas and Alaska never did close access to adoptees. It's time to recognize that the adopted child grows up and their factual original birth certificate and that it rightfully belongs to them, like it does for every other Minnesota-born person. The impact of this legislation on the state's general fund budget will be neutral. The impact on the lives of the adoptees and their descendants will be priceless. And so on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform, I recommend that you pass House File 848. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ms. Needham.
Any other testifiers?
I don't know. Do we have time for one more?
Well, you've actually used up the 10 minutes, so
yeah.
We're going to give the opponents a little opportunity now for about 10 minutes. So, is there anyone here who wants to testify against the bill? And then, I'm sorry, we had...
on the list.
Okay, I don't have the list in front of me. That's right. Okay, I'm sorry. We'll get to you in a second. We've got Andrea Rao.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I'm here representing Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, MCCL. We are a grassroots pro-life organization representing more than 70,000 member families throughout Minnesota. And I'm speaking here today with some concerns with the legislation before you. And I would first like to state that I do have great sympathy for the adoptees and folks birth parents as well, who believe that the right thing to do is to open up these records. But we do believe that the rights of the adoptees have to be balanced with the rights of the birth parents. And the legislation before you today dramatically shifts that balance and really completely, we believe, takes away any recognition at all of the rights of those birth parents who would like to remain anonymous. MCCL has, as I mentioned, serious concerns with this, and our main objections revolve around the following 2 points. One is that this bill does eliminate the option of a truly confidential adoption. This is of concern to MCCL because we believe that women should have that as an option when facing an unexpected pregnancy. Very few women today choose to have a closed or confidential adoption. Almost all opt for an open adoption now. But for those who want to really put the pregnancy behind them, they really only have 2 choices. Those choices are abortion and adoption, and we don't want to see more women being forced into abortion, especially if they would be willing and open to the idea of adoption as long as they had the assurance that their identity could remain confidential and they would be able to really put it behind them, at least in their own mind. Second of all, relates to from our perspective, changing the rules for those adoptions that have already occurred, and the understanding that the women had who chose adoption in the first place. We believe that this really hurts the reputation of adoption. We think that there already exists a stigma in society oftentimes for women to choose to place their child for adoption, and we think that this furthers that stigma rather than lessening it. And so those are the two main objections that we have to this legislation. I could talk much longer, but I know other people want to talk as well, so I'll close with that.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Mr. Neumeister, and then we've got Representative Holbrook as well, I know, wants to, correct? Is there anyone else in the room that wanted to testify against the bill?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. And I'm a privacy advocate, and one for 35 years before the legislature. And so I'm looking at the issue just on a strictly privacy kind of perspective and how I view privacy. I view that when situations happened, when the government or the option was given for to elect privacy or not privacy in the situation, parents at that time decided to elect privacy. And then to somehow 10 years, 15 years, 20, 30 years, 40 years later, change aspects of that to where there's at least under current law some weighing of interest or whatever, I think is not keeping that promise of privacy. Privacy is one of the, depending on who and where, and there's different perspectives, is a very unique thing. And to whether or not those people who chose not to be identified on the original birth record, all of a sudden, several years later, 10 years, decades later, you know, there's just an element there. And privacy is a broad kind of concept. So I would encourage you not to support what is being proposed. But anyways, that's just a general perspective of someone who knows a lot about privacy and involvement with government and how promises are kept on these kinds of issues and what information can do. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And, welcome to the committee, Representative Holbrook. It's rather unusual to have a representative testify on a bill of another representative, but we're glad to have you. Welcome. Unusual, but of course, absolutely no reason not to.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that this is an unusual situation, and the people most opposed to this bill can't come here tonight. And the reason that they can't come here tonight is they have made decisions to keep their privacy and want us as their representatives to uphold that choice. This bill that's before you tonight is unlike past bills that have addressed this issue, and that it doesn't even honor the requests that have been made since 77. There was an opportunity to fill out a non-disclosure form. Since 82, parents were required to sign disclosure or non-disclosure, and it would undo all of those choices. Prior to 77, there wasn't an opportunity for a no disclosure, but the standard was for privacy. And I graduated from high school in 1977. And for many of you in this room, I know at least one person was born in 1977 and some later. But the whole society around unwed births has changed remarkably. It is completely different. And in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, young women that became pregnant, and in some instances because of very horrible situations, rape, incest, had virtually no options. There was no legal abortion. There was very little effective birth control. In addition, they were stigmatized by their societies and in many instances left communities full of shame, went to women's or girls' homes run by Catholic Charities or other organizations, had their babies, were assured that the best thing was to put the baby up for adoption. Don't tell anybody. Go on with your life. And I have some materials here, and I you can see I have a huge folder here, and I know time is limited, but if the page could pass out, just two things. One is a copy of a letter that I received in an envelope, handwritten, with no return address. And as you'll see from the document, this is the original. This wasn't done on a computer. This was done in 2009. This was somebody that was still using a typewriter. Sent me their story, and this person was both an adoptee and a birth mother, urging us not to pass the legislation back in 2009, which would have respected non-disclosure elections that were already in place, would have given 1 year for pre-77s to sign a non-disclosure, and would open it up. And while I certainly respect the position of the advocates for this bill and that it's their information on the birth certificate, you're right, some of it is, but there's other people's information on that birth certificate as well. And I think that we have a need to respect that. This particular issue has been debated across the country in many legislatures over the years, and some of the statistics that I will quote here today are as of 2009. I haven't had time to go through and update them, and from the previous testimony there's a few additional states that have changed. But most states require a court order. Now, the testimony was that there was no way to access this information. There is a way to access this information if both parties agree, through making contact through adoption agency and doing a search. And if both parties agree, a disclosure of birth information and or medical information. But frankly, it doesn't work in every case, and it is a rather cumbersome process. I don't doubt that. But it's not like there is no way, and there's also a court process as well. Currently, about half the states require court order and don't even have this disclosure or non-disclosure scheme in place. Minnesota led the country, was the first state in the country in 1917 that sealed the records. We are a pioneer in the Birth Parent Privacy Act, and while certainly we all recognize that many things have changed, even since 1982, approximately 10% of the parents have elected a non-disclosure standard for that birth situation. So even in recent years, there is a portion of the population. Lutheran Social Services, they weren't able to be here tonight. They were going to testify this morning and saying that they have concerns about the lack of privacy protection in this bill, and also that they were representing Children Home Society. But according to their studies, when they embark on these searches for birth parents, about 25% elect not to disclose and have a reunification. And in fact, some people they found as far away as Africa. So they do try and find people. In 2009, some of the different states that were trying to do this, we actually have had the ACLU chapters in several states, including Washington, Oregon, New Jersey, Illinois, and Connecticut, have opposed a similar legislation. And most recently, over the objections of ACLU, New Jersey passed a law that was vetoed by Governor Christie. There was a bill that passed in, I believe, 2009. In Minnesota, it again allowed and honored current disclosure records on record, and mostly affected the pre-77 birth situations, and that was also vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. This is not a partisan issue. I, in fact, reviewed the vote from that legislation and looked at the bill authors, and something that you don't see too often, even in final passage of that bill, six of the bill authors actually voted against it on the House floor.
At first glance, it sounds like a really good idea. Who wouldn't want to help these people that come to your door have access to their birth records? I understand that. I have family members that have been involved with this issue. My parents adopted two special needs children. I am not without empathy and sympathy for their situation. But when you hear the stories, particularly of the women older than me, and the trauma and the situations that happen to them, in most instances, very alone, young women making very difficult choices with very few options, I think that we owe it to them to continue to protect their privacy and honor a standard that was shared with them at that very traumatic time in their lives.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Holbergen. We've kind of let the opponents go a little bit long here. We appreciate your testimony.
And if I might, the second document was an editorial that the Star Tribune wrote in 2009 opposing that legislation as well.
Get that handed out as well. Yeah. And so, members, why don't we open it up for questions? And I'm going to give Representative Portman some more time, and I think you want to make sure that we're fair and we give both sides equal time as well.
Sorry.
It's okay. It's obviously an issue about which people feel very passionate on both sides, and so, but actually, as circumstances have it, we were able to give it a bit more time than we would have been this morning, and I think that actually turned out to be a good thing, notwithstanding the making people hang out. Members, why don't we take this time to ask questions if there are some, and then Representative Portman, you want to?
I just want to make two quick points in response to the testimony. In Ohio, the legislature is looking at this very issue right now. A week ago, the Ohio Right to Life community testified in favor of a bill like this. And what they expressed is my opinion on this issue, which is as long as we have secrecy, we imply shame. We imply that an unwanted pregnancy is something shameful and that people should hide. And I think that that encourages people to choose abortion. I think that this, you know, I don't want to make this a pro-life, pro-choice debate, but I do think that the net effect of enacting this bill is to have more women choose to carry their child to term and give it up for adoption, because we remove that blanket of shame that right now is over the act of adoption. And there was a representation made that all these women were promised that their names would never be disclosed. There are only a very small number of affidavits of non-disclosure on file in the entire state. I think it numbers in approximately 1,200 that have been filed between 1977.
Okay, thank you, Representative Portman. So, on the list, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Representative Portman, I signed on to this as a co-author initially, and the reason is I did like some of the provisions in terms of streamlining and reducing cost. You know, one of the things, and I haven't adopted any children, but I know people who have, obviously. I mean, you just can't believe the cost and hoops they have to go through, and I'm sure they're well intended, but this bill does seem to streamline some of those things. Do you want to speak to that for just a minute? Would it actually reduce cost 10%, maybe 20%?
Representative Portman?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, there is no fiscal note on the bill, and I'm sure Representative Liebling would rather that I not speak to fiscal issues since this is not a fiscal committee, but right now, the Department of Human Services does have to undergo some efforts when a child is seeking their original birth certificate. In each case, the Department of Human Services has to contact the agency, which then has to do a search for the birth parents if they're still alive and can be located. And the Department of Human Services has to manage that process. I have no idea how much it costs.
Oh.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, is there any solution to the pro and con sides in this situation? On the surface, it seems to be extremely difficult, and I you know, really appreciate Representative Holberg's perspective, having been on involved in these situations. Anyway, your thoughts?
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I think that there is more work that can be done on the bill to improve it through the process as we go forward to address the concerns that have been raised. And I do plan to continue to work with people on the bill to improve it and make it better. I think the difficult thing is a birth certificate has two people's names on it.
Yeah.
It has the people who biologically created that child, and it has that child's name. And we are balancing the rights of those people. And I think we're, Representative Holberg and I, in the unusual position of, in this case, she's advocating that the rights of the woman are greater than the rights of the child. And I am advocating that they all have the same rights with respect to that birth certificate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have an amendment to offer, the 848-DE1. I'd like to move that.
Representative Abler moves the 848-DE1.
Madam Chair, I'm former rep from Tingelstad, worked on this for quite some time, and she persuaded me of the challenges of it, and I became kind of enamored with all the personalities and the pain of the the people that are trying to figure out their roots and their medical histories and all that. And I'm a co-author, but I'm a conflicted co-author. So I'm sympathetic to the outcomes, and it's a daunting topic, Representative Hortman, and I appreciate you doing that. I'm presenting this as a, I believe this was, the content, this was at least a plateau of agreement from the past. And as Representative Hortman goes forward, this might be helpful to her. So I was going to ask Ms. Aves if she would just describe it for me, please.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Aves.
Madam Chair and members, this is a fairly short three-section delete everything amendment. And one of the major sections is that it allows an adopted person, even if there is an affidavit of non-disclosure on file, to request non-identifying medical and social history information, and it would require that the birth parent provide that non-identifying information once that request has been placed before them by an agent of a licensed child placing agency. It also extends the time for the birth parent to respond to requests from 30 days to 60 days.
Saves. Representative Abler.
Trying to get the mic for the tape. This is a cozy house you have, Madam Chair. I feel like we're all kind of warm and together here. We're sitting warm and we're sitting together. And I listened to my colleague, Representative Holberg, and hit the passion on her side, and I don't know the answer. So I bring this forward as something that was agreed upon in the past. At least if you can help some groups in some way, that's a good day. If this were adopted and became law, I think it would give some help that would be beneficial. But Madam Chair, it's not my bill, it's not my project. And I'm here in an advisory role, and I have a bill up another committee pretty soon, but I wanted to offer this. And so I'm not going to take it to a vote, so I'm going to withdraw it, but I want to at least make members aware of a previous agreement that seemed like people agreed on something, the best of my recollection, and in an effort to help further the cause. And I don't know if this would go on, if it would relieve it of its duty to go to another committee, which might make it meet deadline. And if that, after I leave, if somebody wants to offer it for real, and if Representative Hortman wants to do it, then that's
for real.
But I admire her for her effort in this. I'm so sympathetic to the both groups in the audience that have a desire for information and status and knowledge, and those who are concerned about the very same thing. So thank you, Madam Chair. If I could excuse the rest, I'll...
Thank you, Representative Abler. And Representative Portman, do you want to comment on this?
Yes, Madam Chair. This amendment would really gut the bill and isn't what people want to know. Some people try to find their biological parents because of a desire for medical or social history, but some have other reasons, and it's a part, you know, we all go through a process of figuring out who we are and our identity in this world, and who your parents are is a part of your identity, and this is too limiting. When this was offered in 2009, the advocates who wanted to pass the bill that I bring in front of you today said we would rather not have anything than this. There was a bill that did reach Governor Pawlenty's desk, and I thought that's what Representative Abler's amendment was going to be, and that would have been a different and more rich discussion.
All right, thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Representative Abler withdraws the DE1 amendment.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the one question I have for the author, if I heard you correctly, and I guess before I ask my question, and it maybe goes without saying for many of the people on the table, sympathetic to both sides of this issue, and I've had conversations in my office with people on both sides, and so I'm trying to get a handle on this, but I guess, you know, at this point, I have a lot of concerns in terms of, for instance, you referenced that there's a relatively small number of those affidavits of non-disclosure on record, 1,200, I think you said. And, you know, I don't know compared to other states. When you said it was a relatively small number, I thought it would have been like under 100 or something. 1,200, that's still a lot of people out there who would be affected very substantially, potentially, by this bill. And if so, if I'm understanding correctly, this bill would essentially undo the ability of those 1,200 affidavits to keep that completely private. Is that correct? If this bill were to pass, those affidavits of non-disclosure would become null and void, and those women would possibly open themselves up or be opened up to being contacted when they thought they would never be contacted. Is that correct?
Representative Horton.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that is correct, but some of these affidavits of non-disclosure were filed when the women gave birth, and so we are talking about a time period that is at least 18 years after the birth. Those 1,200 people, women, may not remember they signed one and may feel very differently at this point in time.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mack.
Do you know, Representative Hortman, are all of those, so I know that we've talked about since 1982 where there was an option for women to go back and either sign a non-disclosure at that point or not. Is that 1,200 number, does that include anyone from 1982 on as well? Is that 1,200 number includes all of that? Is that correct?
Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, in 2007, the Minnesota Coalition for Adoption Reform paid for a count of affidavits of disclosure. I guess there's another kind of affidavit as well, an affidavit of disclosure, and a non-disclosure on file. 90% of the people who filed the document from 1981 to 2007 stated their preference for future contact. So there are, in the state of Minnesota, as of 2007, 11,683 affidavits of disclosure wanting future contact, and 1,228 affidavits of non-disclosure wanting no contact.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Mack.
Sorry, I lost my train of thought for just a second. So I guess my question then is, those women you referenced that maybe they forgot that they signed it or have changed their mind, if they have changed their mind, they would have the ability to go to the Department of Health or wherever, get to their file and say, hey, I want to change my, I had a non-disclosure, now I'd like to change it to disclosure. They have the option. They have the option to do that if they're somewhere in the state or in the country and they're thinking about this decision they made a long time ago and they're reconsidering. They can go in and change that file if they want to, right? It's not a final agreement that can't be changed. Is that correct?
Representative Portman.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, theoretically, yes, but as in any process in government that's out there that's available, it's only available if people know about it and think about it. And these are forms that were signed probably at the most stressful and difficult times in these people's lives. And to think that they had processed the idea that they signed this form that had this meaning that they could change, they may or may not remember that or know that.
And Madam Chair, just one final.
Representative Mack, we do have quite a few members on the list.
Okay.
So.
No, and I appreciate that. And I guess that's, for me, just the biggest hang-up at this point is for those 1,200 women and understanding, yes, it was a stressful time, but I guess... you know, I'm sure it's something that many of those women comes to mind from time to time. It's a pretty, you know, giving birth is a pretty memorable experience, and things can get blurry around that time. But I guess I just, you know, I would find it more likely that if this is something that still really ruminates with them and they have a desire to be possibly accessed or contacted by their child, that they would find a way to do that if they truly wanted that. And so my hang-up is undoing those 1,200 and what that means for those women. So I look forward to continuing to listen and appreciate what we're trying to accomplish, but do have major concerns.
Okay, members, we have four people on the list, and I want to get to a vote on this bill, and so let's, we can just try to be a little bit expeditious on this. Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really tough for me because I've had the women in support of this in my office and over the last couple of years, and I felt very sure that I was supportive of this bill until I really listened to Representative Holberg. And I guess what's got me very concerned here is that we did make a promise. Representative Holberg talks about graduating in 77, and it was a different day. I graduated in 1972. And I know that that was a different day and age. And these women that made this decision and that don't want to be found out, we made a promise to them. And I don't know how we can go back on our promise. And that's my concern right now. I'm just not comfortable about that. And Representative, when you say that these people maybe have forgotten or whatever, I would venture to guess that there's not one single day that they go through where they don't remember giving birth and they don't think about their child. And if they really wanted to or felt that it was comfortable and the right thing to do, that they would contact and they would open up these records. So I just feel like, for me, it's going back on a promise, and I'm just not comfortable with doing that. So thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And like probably everyone around the table, we've heard from people from both sides. I would say to Representative Mack, it's far more than 1,200, because the people before 77 that I've talked to, and they're elderly, they believe they were promised. Back then, we didn't do things with a lot of paperwork. We didn't have data privacy laws, and we didn't have all the stuff that we have nowadays. But they went through a pregnancy of, you know, at whatever point they realized they were there, of, you know, 6 or 7 months, no matter how much they denied it, that they were in that circumstance. And they know how they got into that circumstance. And they made a choice that was just heart-wrenching, in which they believed they were giving up something that they, that was a part of them, to the care of someone else. And they thought that was a really big gift. And part of the gift, and this is really hard for anyone to share, but part of the gift was sparing that child, knowing that their parent, their father, was a rapist. I mean, some of this was a gift, not just in terms of giving that child up to potentially a couple that couldn't conceive and couldn't take care, that could give that child a much stabler home, and by a couple who really, really was ready and wanted to have a child and welcome them into their child home. But it was also because they could not only go through the shame, but they could not also face ask the constant questions from that child about, tell me about my father. And, I mean, I presented a bill this morning in which, you know, over 20% of women have been raped. I mean, that's just crazy. We have to do something about this, but we are stepping up to it far more than previous generations did, when it was all blamed on the woman. And the shame was terrible. I mean, people felt they had to leave their hometown, and they never returned. They gave up all connections to their friends, to their family, except for an occasional return home at Christmas, because of the shame that that put into their life. And they started a new life, and the new people they met never knew. And they think about that child every year on their birthday and send them the best of wishes. And I just really feel like we have to honor that promise. I think if we want to change the laws going forward, I am there. It's a different time. It's a different place. But I think we just really have to honor the commitment made to the past, because they're not all happy reunifications. I celebrate with the people who've had those happy reunions. But I also have had the tears in my office from people who lived in a different time and now are just terrorized by the thought that something may revisit them.
I've got Representative Albright and Representative Allen, and then I'd like to get to a vote on the bill. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You know, this isn't a dialogue that is without empathy for the situations that anyone that makes a decision to give up a child is fraught with. But we, as legislators, have to abide by the rights granted and the covenants promised in the past. And as Representative Hortman mentioned, there are those that wished to be available for disclosure, and she also referenced a goodly number, as well as Representative Loeffler referenced that it's more than 1,200 that have chosen not to divulge the circumstances that prevailed at the time of birth and leading up to it. And that's it's irrevocable, but in the same sense, as I've read the commentary that was provided and from the testimony from Representative Holberg, I think it, you know, a bit lighthearted, but in my own circumstance with my own wife, if a mama bear wants to do something, she will find a way. And I use that as an encouragement for those that are seeking out the opportunity to find their birth children, biological children, that there will be a way. I understand that sometimes it's lengthy and it's costly, but I think that when this state and we as stewards of the rights of all people, not just those that have disclosed, but for those that have opted not to disclose, even if it was some time ago, that is a covenant that we embraced, that we need to abide by, and that we need to defend.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Final word, or last question anyway, goes to Representative Allen.
Oh, there's too many questions. It's like, because I know there's a lot of data on kids that have been adopted and the impact it has on them, and we have a lot of data on how how this impacts kids that have been adopted, and how it, you know, whether there are identity problems, achievement gap, mental health problems, and I think that the 1,200 women that I don't think the state made. And that these are private adoption aids, that we didn't promise them anything, basically, and we don't have and there's no privity of any contract. We didn't fund these adoptions. You say there's like you're honoring the decision they made, that they thought it was going to be not disclosed. Okay, that's given, but back, you know, that back then, that time, like people talk, it was shameful. But I would also like to say that during that very time when those adoptions were going on, the number of children that were removed from homes during that time and placed in adoption, often without any investigation, and many of them were from poor homes, and some of them were from Indian people. For example, by 1970, in Michigan, one out of every eight adoptions in that state was an Indian child. And one out of every 90 children in foster care was Indian, and yet the population for Indians is less than 1%, and that still goes on today. But so you have interracial adoptions who have a long history, and I can't imagine that if you contact these mothers, the adoptee will proceed cautiously. They're not going to. I mean, we're now in the days with internet, you can find, you know, your history, genealogy. You can look up, and they may not even contact them, but at least they would know where they came from, what race they were, if they were Indian, what tribe they came from. I mean, that and so I think we talk about times changing, and this is one of those things. It's time to change, and I don't think we give the women, these 1,200 women, enough credit, because I think many of them would be able and strong enough to deal with this now.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Thank you, members, for very thoughtful and respectful discussion, and
Representative Hortman, would you like to close before I call for a vote?
Well, Madam Chair, you know, I didn't know if you were going to try to even out the time, but one of the people that we didn't hear from was a birth mother. And I didn't know if you wanted to allow 2 minutes from an actual birth mother, since that was the majority of the commentary and questions.
Sure, I think we could do that. But we won't take any other questions, members, after that. We'll just let her speak, and then I think we will be ready to vote. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I am Kathy O'Malley, a birth mother, a retired county social worker, and a member of Concerned United Birth Parents. I placed 2 infant sons. I wasn't going to do this for adoption in 1962 and 1967. These were painful and traumatic events for me. However, I placed them as everyone advised me that it was in their best interests, and I was convinced that without the resources of a loving and stable family, it would be a hardship for all of us. I was never promised secrecy. I don't remember any of that. I always had the hopes of being reunited with them when they became adults. So that was in the 60s. Now, as a birth mother, I support this legislation. Adult adoptees should have a right to their original birth certificates. I do not consider this a threat to birth parents, and I don't feel that birth parents should have the power to deny adult adoptees this information. As a member of Concerned United Birth Parents, we support the unrestricted access of adopted people to their original birth certificates. It's part of our mission to provide support, resources, and referrals to anyone coping with the effects of adoption secrecy and separation. For me, the secrecy was not being able to talk about it. As a retired social worker with experience in placing older children for adoptive placements, I support this legislation as I witnessed how important it is to be open and honest with all members of the adoption triad. Adult adoptees should be treated with respect and have the same rights and responsibilities as all adults in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Hortman.
Madam Chair, I think as a result of the testimony that's been raised by members, there's really a concern about those affidavits of non-disclosure, and that is an issue that has to be really properly addressed. And I think although the amendment that was adopted did address that in part, it did not address the concerns that were raised. And I would prefer that you lay the bill over and we'll bring it up before your committee at a different time with an amendment that deals with that more fully.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hortman. Thank you, members. I'm going to lay the bill over. And we are adjourned.